Women in Harmony, a women's social justice chorus in Portland, Maine, actually, preparing for its Right to Vote concert, where it will sing women's suffrage songs from the period. I think a good way to start our program, this portion of our program today, as we take a look at the 100th anniversary of women's right to vote. And Wisconsin was the first state to ratify the 19th Amendment. So with us to talk about and celebrate the suffrage movement is Simone Munson. She's the Collection Development Coordinator for the Wisconsin Historical Society, where she supervises the acquisition of collections for the library and archives. Holds a master's degree in history from the University of New Mexico, as well as a master's in Library and Information Sciences from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Simone Munson, welcome. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I really appreciate it. And as you listen to Simone and I talk, what do you want to know about the history of women's right to vote? Do you maybe have a story to share about women's suffrage? Join in. Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Simone, let's talk about the suffrage movement. When did it start, and when did it really gain momentum?
Sure. I mean, it's always hard to put a pinpoint on when a movement really starts. You know, we can look all the way back to the founding of our country, and Abigail Adams writes to her husband as he's working to draft the Constitution saying, you know, remember the women. And if you don't, I'm paraphrasing here, but if you don't remember the women, we'll be forced to rebel. And so, you know, I think the idea of women's suffrage and women's rights has been always kind of part of our country's history. It's always been thought about since the founding of the country. But really what we think of as the modern suffrage movement starts to gain momentum in the late 1840s. People often refer to the Seneca Falls Convention, which took place in New York in a town called Seneca Falls. And there were a lot of very well-known suffragists who attended that convention. It was 2 days long, and women were invited to the first day. It was only women on the first day, and they spoke about the rights of women and why women's rights were important and how they could gain those rights. And then on the second day, they invited men to attend the lectures as well so that they could try and convince men about the importance of women's rights. And it's really after this big convention in New York that we see women like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and then a few years later, Susan B. Anthony starting to really sort of make names for themselves. They would go on speaking tours and they would publish newspapers and they would get the word out about women's rights and suffrage. And in Wisconsin, we sort of see the movement start around the same time, a little bit later. We have a much smaller population here in Wisconsin at the time, but the issue was at the forefront enough that it was taken up very briefly during the state constitutional convention. Our first state constitutional convention in 1846, the delegates did briefly discuss the idea of women's suffrage, and it wasn't included in our state constitution, but it was sort of discussed on the floor very briefly. So it's about a 70-year process between the, you know, the late 1840s up through 1920 to sort of get the suffrage amendment approved and through the federal Congress.
Yeah. So the momentum, when did it really gain momentum?
Yeah, so, I mean, it does go through some sort of fits and starts. And in the 1880s, we see that women are really getting organized. We, the women's club movement across the country starts to organize local clubs, and the suffrage associations around the country start to gain some perspective, some standing. And what we see in the 1870s and 1880s is there's a lot of women who are working on getting state and local rights. So they sort of realize that a federal amendment is the dream one day, but that for right now, if they can convince some states to give them the right to vote in state and local elections, that they could influence the federal movement by gaining ground in the states. So in the 1870s and 1880s, we see that there are states that are trying to give women the right to vote. And that plays out in a lot of different ways. Wyoming is the first state to grant full suffrage to women, and they write it into their constitution. In some states, women are allowed to vote on specific issues. So in Wisconsin, we see in the 1880s, there's a movement to allow women to vote in elections related to school matters, so they could vote on things like the school board and in local and municipal elections that had an impact on school, because there was a natural alignment with sort of the traditional role of women and raising children, and they saw a connection to schools, and so they wanted to allow women to vote in those elections. Now, unfortunately, the law wasn't written very clearly, and so when women showed up to actually cast their ballots, they were often denied ballots because it wasn't very clear what a school matter was. And the other thing that was difficult is that they didn't print separate ballots for the women, and so if they handed a regular ballot to a woman, there was no way to ensure that they weren't voting for things that they weren't supposed to vote for. So it got very confusing very quickly. And the matter in Wisconsin wasn't really resolved until around 1900.
So it took a long time, 20 more years.
Yeah. We have to remember that these civil and legal processes, they take time to enact, right? And so sometimes the movement can be slow. Wisconsin does have a referendum to try and grant statewide suffrage to all women in 1912, but that movement was unsuccessful. And that's partially because in Wisconsin, the suffrage movement was very closely aligned with the temperance movement, and the Brewers and Germans of Wisconsin did not support women's suffrage, partially because they did not want to support temperance or prohibition of alcohol. So,
yeah, I could see where that would make sense to some people. Oh, my goodness me. We are talking about the 100th anniversary of the Vote for Women with our guest today, Simone Munson. She is the Collection Development Coordinator for the Wisconsin Historical Society, where she supervises collections for the library and archives. Great to have her with us today, and she'll be with us right up until 12:30. We are going to take a look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And we certainly encourage you to call in with your own experiences or questions at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, this year marks the 100th anniversary of women's right to vote. With us to talk about this movement, Simone Munson. She's the Collection Development Coordinator for the Wisconsin Historical Society. She supervises the acquisition of collections for the library and the archives. So, do you have a story to share about the women's right to vote movement? What do you want to know about Wisconsin's role in women's suffrage? Love to hear from you. Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Again, love to hear from you, so give a call or shoot us an email. Love to hear from you. Well, Simone, what were some of the strategies? You mentioned one strategy used to convince men that women should have the right to be allowed to vote. But what were, and that had to do with, at the state level, allowing votes relating to to education, because women were thought of, you know, to be connected to that. But what were some other strategies?
Yeah, so the, you know, the strategies used across the country are different from state to state. In some states, temperance is actually a successful motivator for people to align with the suffrage movement. And there are states where, you know, being pro-temperance and pro-suffrage works well for women, and they're able to get more rights to vote there. There's also just the idea of convincing the population that that women do play a role in politics and the economy. And what ends up being the most successful strategy for the federal amendment is to talk about those connections to politics and the economy within the context of World War One. So during World War One, women, much like World War Two, are, you know, sent out into the workplace, and they're really what's keeping the American economy going while our armies are overseas fighting. And by making this strong connection to the role of women in the war movement, they're also able to advocate for the vote by saying that we play an important role in politics and the economy, and that the U.S. wouldn't be able to win the war without our help.
Is that really what, you know, you're trying to imagine now what the thinking was about why women wouldn't be able to vote? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm trying to think of what the mindset was like.
Yeah, so it's interesting to look at the anti-suffrage movement to sort of get an answer to that question. So why would somebody have been anti-suffrage? And I mentioned before the break that there were sort of seen as these natural spheres, right? These natural spheres that were based somewhat on sex or gender, where men were involved in business and politics and the economy, and women held more of a domestic sphere, kind of a traditional role of women in child raising and things like that. And for a lot of people, men and women, they just didn't see those spheres crossing. They sort of thought that it was unnatural. And so they thought that, you know, women belonged over here on this side and men on the other side, and through the role of politics, then men had the right to vote, and that's how society worked. The other thing was that, you know, women also, or a lot of people also thought that that women were represented through their fathers and their husbands' votes. So they sort of assumed that if you gave women the right to vote, it would just be doubling the vote. They would just vote the same way that their husbands and fathers voted. So it was unnecessary because they were represented by their fathers and husbands, which I always kind of laugh at that, because there's plenty of women who don't vote like their fathers or their husbands.
You got that right. Tia in Cumberland has something for us. Tia, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. I'm a huge fan of the show and frequent caller. Thanks for taking my call today. My comment is basically, I would like for us to start changing the verbiage that we use around this particular topic. This isn't something that was given to us, and it's not something that we won. This is something that we fought for, that we continue to fight for, that is still not equal. and equal access is not granted to all women. There are a lot of minority women who live in neighborhoods where they don't have access to their voting facilities and need to take multiple means of transportation in order to get there, or work jobs that don't allow them time off during the time that the voting stations are open to go and place their vote. So we haven't won anything, and it hasn't been given to us. It's something we fight for. It's something we have been fighting for 100 years and more. So I that would be my comment, and I will take your comments and listen in off air. Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling, Tia. Simone, comment.
I completely agree. This year, when we were working on the celebration for the suffrage amendment, one of the things we wanted to do was to design an exhibit that talked about how the 19th Amendment was really just a first step, and what were all the things that needed to come after the 19th Amendment in order to open those doors even wider, right? So it's important to realize that the 19th Amendment doesn't grant everyone the right to vote. So the 19th Amendment just states that you can't deny or abridge the right to vote based on sex. But in practice, we know that not all women were allowed to vote. Native Americans often weren't able to exercise their right to vote until the Indian Citizenship Act of 1924. And as we know, because of racism in our country and Jim Crow laws, many African-American women were not able to vote, and men, for that matter, were not able to vote until the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And so when we talk about voting rights, it's important to realize that the fight or the struggle changes over time, but it's not completely equal even today.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a bit more about that 19th Amendment and what Wisconsin's role was and who were some of the key players in it.
Yeah, well, it's very fitting that we're talking about this today because Wisconsin was the first state to ratify the 19th Amendment. We voted in June of 1919. And today is actually the anniversary of Tennessee ratifying the 19th Amendment, and Tennessee was the 36th state to ratify, and that's the final state that was needed in order to make it an amendment to the Constitution. So after Tennessee voted on August 18th, then the amendment went back to the federal government and was added to the Constitution officially on August 26th. So we're right around that anniversary date. Wisconsin was the first state to ratify. It's an honor we share with a couple other states, but Wisconsin was the first to turn our papers into the State Department in Washington, D.C. So we are the first state to ratify. And there's, a number of women who help get there. The papers themselves were delivered by a man named David James, and David was the father of Ada James, and his wife Laura were all from Richland Center, and they were strong advocates of the suffrage movement. David is the legislator who introduced the bills that made that 1912 referendum possible, and really his daughter, his wife, and others were leading what we would call a grassroots campaign to gain support and convince women to men and women to support the movement.
So they were key players at that time.
Yeah, and that 1912 referenda unfortunately failed. And what we see after the failure of that referendum in Wisconsin is that a lot of the suffragists in Wisconsin kind of lose a little bit of faith in the idea that they can do this state by state. And they really want to focus on the federal amendment. And so we see women like Carrie Chapman Catt, who was born in Ripon, Wisconsin, and Belle Case La Follette, and Olympia Brown, who have connections to Wisconsin, really becoming part of these national suffrage organizations and helping to come up with a strategy that would eventually lead to the federal amendment.
Yeah. So the the voting, you said that it did not obviously include everybody in the amendment.
That's right. So the amendment itself doesn't restrict, right? So the 15th Amendment says that you can't restrict voting based on race, color, or previous condition of servitude. So that gives African Americans the right to vote after the Civil War. And the 19th Amendment says that you can't deny or abridge voting rights based on sex. But we know in practice that that those things did still happen through much of the 20th century.
Yeah. I want to go back to World War One again. You just briefly mentioned the impact of World War One. Talk a bit more about that.
Sure. So President Wilson actually runs on an anti-suffrage campaign. So he wins the presidency saying that the time is not right for women's suffrage. This is sort of that era of the suffrage movement where we see the women organizing marches and women who are wearing their sashes or wearing the sort of regalia of the suffrage movement organizing marches. And there's large marches that are organized in 1916 in Chicago before the Republican National Convention. Basically, the suffragists want them to know that they are there and that they matter. And then in Washington, D.C., the day before President Wilson's inauguration, there's the largest march. For a long time, it was the largest march in Washington, D.C.'s history, up until the more recent Women's March, where the suffragists took to the street the day before his inauguration. And it was representatives from all the states at the time who wanted to make it known that while Wilson had run on an anti-suffrage campaign, that they weren't going anywhere. And then we often see pictures from this time period of women picketing outside the White House. And there was a quote that said, you know, they wanted to be the first thing he saw in the morning when he woke up and the last thing he saw before he went to bed. And so there were protesters who stood outside the White House for a very, very long time. And so, like I mentioned before, the argument during World War One was that, you know, women played a very important role in the war effort. And their support of the economy and politics and business of the United States was instrumental in winning the war. And the other piece of it, too, is that if you look at the Allied countries, there's an international aspect to this, too, because if you look at the Allied countries of the United States, of Great Britain and France in particular, they had both already granted women the right to vote. And so on the international stage, the United States was starting to seem a little bit backwards compared to their allies, that they hadn't granted women the right to vote.
You kind of mentioned this a little in passing. There were some iconic symbols of the movement, the colors. And what colors did they wear?
Yeah, so probably the most prominent color in the United States that's used is a very bright gold or yellow. And the story behind that color is that the women of Kansas were the first women to start wearing that sort of goldenrod color. It was supposed to represent the sunflowers of Kansas, and they used that to represent the movement. And other states and women from around the country started using that color as well. We often see suffragists wearing gold, purple, and white. Those are the three colors that really represent the movement, and those could have been represented in sashes or pins in the dresses they wore themselves. And so when they organized these large marches, that tended to be what they wore.
Yeah. What were the, maybe other traditions or perhaps slogans that were in play? And why were they important?
You know, votes for women is the most common one that we see on signs and things of the time. Even, you know, I mentioned the sunflowers from Kansas. People would sort of wear lapels, pins, and things like that in the shape of sunflowers to represent the movement as well. And really, they were just a very non-intrusive way of showing your support for the movement. So women could walk down the street and they would understand, you know, that there were other women supporting their cause if they saw them. So.
Mm. Does the Historical Society have some of those pins and so forth?
Yeah, so unfortunately, our museum is closed right now because of the pandemic.
Right.
But when shortly before the pandemic, we had just launched our most recent exhibit on the suffrage amendment, and that includes things like the bright yellow tunics that Wisconsin women wore in to that large march that I mentioned to the Republican National Convention, which was in Chicago in 1916, as well as some of the banners and pennants and pins that women would have worn at the time.
Hmm. And the Historical Society you're hosting a virtual event next week, right? Tell us about that celebration.
Sure. So in coordination with the Governor's Commission for the Centennial of the 19th Amendment of the Suffrage Amendment, we're asking people on August 26th, which is the day that the amendment actually takes effect, to wear white in peaceful demonstration, like the suffragists and women 100 years ago did. And at noon, wherever you are, if you could go outside and ring a bell or make some noise in some way to celebrate the moment. 100 years ago, on August 26th, that is what women did. They had impromptu parades. They went outside and they made noise. They rang bells. You know, church bells rang or school bells rang. And they really just tried to celebrate the moment together at noon on the 26th. And so in this time where we have to socially distance and be precautious, this is actually something that we can do that our you know, women did 100 years ago and still be safe.
Well, let's see. I have a news break at noon.
So run outside and ring a bell.
I can run outside and ring a bell. That's not a bad idea. I might just do that or honk my horn or something. Honk the car horn. If you're in a car, honk your horn. And where can folks find out more about women's suffrage?
Sure. So there's some information on our website, wisconsinhistory.org. And there are a number of books that have been published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press and other local presses regarding, you know, suffragists specifically or women's history just more generally. So, you know, if you don't have a book on women's history in your collection, maybe the suffrage movement is a good place to start.
Yeah. Off the top of your head, do you have a book or two that you would recommend?
So there's definitely biographies of a lot of the well-known suffragists. You know, Belle Case La Follette is a Wisconsin woman who comes to mind. Otherwise, there's Women's Wisconsin History by Genevieve McBride, which is a great resource on women's history in the state.
So a couple of good books there, and. This has been a lot of fun talking. As you were talking, I was thinking, man, the organization of that of this movement must have been. I suppose it might have seemed a little hit and miss at the time, but it must have been a pretty superb, smart bunch of people who put this together over time.
Yeah, it's definitely a movement that if we look at the organization of modern movements, we can see sort of the beginnings of what we think of as modern grassroots movements starting in the suffrage movement.
Yeah, I just, and the key, probably if you were going to name two or three women in Wisconsin and then nationally who were prominent in this, who would they be?
I mean, I think that, Belcase the Follett and Ada James would probably be some of the people I would choose for Wisconsin. When we think about the movement nationally, you know, names like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony come to mind. But I would also really encourage people to try and research or read about suffragists that they might not have read about in the past. The African American women's suffrage movement was a very vital part of our country's history as well. And women like Mary Church Terrell, Ida B. Wells, and Fannie Barr Williams are also really important women to remember in the movement.
Simone, thank you so much for taking time to be with us. I really appreciate it. And I'll go ring my bell
on the 26th.
So August 26th at noon, I will vacate the microphone and run outside and ring my bell. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Simone Munson, Collection Development Coordinator for the Wisconsin Historical Society. Great to have her with us and talk today about the 100th anniversary of the Vote for Women. And I want to thank you all for listening in as well. Phil Pelletieri joins us again tomorrow on the show at 11, so I hope you can join us for that, talk about insects. In the meantime, thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mehler.